When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
It's time for an adventurous episode of the Imbalanced History of Rock and Roll. I'm Ray Koob.
I'm Marcus Goldman.
And as always, we're brought to you by our friends at Crooked Eye Brewery in the heart of Hatboro, pouring the cure for over 10 years now. Wow, good stuff there at Crooked Eye. Good stuff on the podcast this week too, right, buddy?
Absolutely. With us today is someone who had a huge impact on fashion, music, style, and so much more during the early 1970s in the UK, which then spread worldwide and hit Philadelphia especially hard. She wrote a book that will be available April 4th everywhere, telling this incredible story from a completely different viewpoint. Someone immersed in the happenings at the time, the book called Me and Mr. Jones, My Life with David Bowie and the Spiders from Mars. The author is Susie Ronson, wife of the late, great Mick Ronson. Susie, welcome, and thank you for sharing your story.
Oh, you're very welcome.
Before we really start talking about the book, and we don't want to give too much away because we really want people to read about it, but what made you decide to share this part of the story with the world?
I think because I had a very different story than most people. I mean, there's a lot of books have been written about David Bowie. A lot of books. A lot of books have chronicled every date that he did, every note that he played. Well, my story isn't like that. My story's about being around at the juncture, really, of his success. He'd had Space Oddity, but it had been a couple of years before I met him. He was struggling, I bet, to find a way forward. He was singing folk music at the Three Tuns pub in Beckenham, which is where my hairdressing salon was. And I don't think he quite found his way forward. He had Angie, who was always amazing, his wife, so much energy. He got his manager, Tony DeFries, who was incredible at finding the way forward. And he found Mick Ronson and the band from Hull. So he was at that pivotal moment. I mean, when I cut David's hair, he was just a guy that played in the pub downtown.
And we're at that moment, that pivotal moment, where the story really turns, and it's early in the book, and turns things up a notch, and kind of puts you on pins and needles at times, waiting for them to call and say, when am I coming around to do another do, if you will? It's that time when Angie calls you at the salon, and, you know, they're all stressing because, you know, they want it to be really good. I guess it's the show at Haddon Hall, right? But you get the call to go visit them and help them sort out his hair for this upcoming gig. And that's really where things start to change, get you right in the middle of things that are going on there in the Jones household, so to speak. And the way you tell the story, I just want to say this at the beginning of our chat. Your attention and memory for detail is to be commended. And it's amazing because you have all the stories. You remember who was in the room and what they were doing and things like that. And I don't know how you remember all that shit because I can't remember what I had for lunch yesterday.
I have my diaries. I have my diary from 19. And that really helped. I'd always written a bit about tours and stuff. And I also had my tour books. So after every show, I'd write a little synopsis of what went on in that show. So that kind of kept my timeline straight. Going up there, I wasn't going there to do David's hair. I was going there to do Angie's hair. We couldn't fit her in. It was Christmas. She couldn't fit her in. So I went outside and I said, I can come to your house to do your hair. And that's when I met David. And that's when they started talking about cutting his hair short. And then he showed me the photograph and I just said, yeah, I can do that. And I chopped it off that night.
And at that point, you had mentioned in both the book and in our conversation that you had kept journals and diaries. Were you keeping diaries and journals of your work up to the point where you met Angie and your life started changing? Was this something you were always already practicing?
I'd practiced during various times in my life, various exciting times. I went to Italy for a while when I was 17, and I kept a journal then. I went to the States for a while when I was in my 20s, and I kept my journal then. But this really was more a comment on what the shows were like. And before I went on the road, it's funny because it gets to a point where I'm going to America, and then I've just got Phoenix and LA. I've just got dates, and I haven't got any more entries.
Well, that's a lot more than some of us ever had, so don't sweat the small stuff there. You know, you had the moment with your mom where she picks up the melody maker. Oh, see, this is your friends, eh? You know, like she finally realizes what kind of circles you've been running in because it's right there in front of her. And that must have been pretty cool. I know I had some stuff like that with my folks early in my career where they were like, really? Huh?
Well, she wasn't too impressed, I have to say. But, you know, as I said, Mum, he's married. He's got a child. They're just saying it for the papers. You know, they're saying it for the papers. And whether they were or not, I didn't care. He did have a wife and he did have a child, and it certainly calmed her down.
Well, that helps, I guess, in situations like that. But no one really understood of her generation, and even of the people who were in our generation or our age group, what was going on in Haddon Hall, because people knew that David lived there and Ange lived there. But there were stories, I guess, around because there was so much partying going on. And you describe some of the aftermath in a couple places really well in the book. So people get a picture. They can paint that picture in their mind of what it was like to be there and experience it as it was happening. Because most of us who are kids in the States wondered what was going on right before all that hit. You know?
It's a bit shocking to me, too, to be honest with you. I was so suburban. And David and Angie were the most exciting people I'd ever met. I didn't even know people like David and Angie existed until I met them. But my life was dull compared to theirs. They had a very exciting time running up and around in London and all the clubs, having just the best time. I mean, I wasn't doing that. I went up to London here and there, but I wasn't doing things that they were doing. Their laugh sounded fabulous, much more fabulous than mine was.
Do you remember seeing David Jones as the folk singer in the pub right around the corner from you back in the day before you actually met him? Did you go see him? Were you going to see live music at that time?
I was going to see live music, but I was going to see Pink Floyd. I was going to see Luchino Washington, the Ram Jam Band. Folk music wasn't really my thing. I never went to see him in the pub. But the first time I saw him, he was walking down Beckenham High Street wearing a dress. That's the first time I actually saw David. Then I met Angie. And of course, Angie was so incredibly different to any of these old girls I used to do in the salon. And doing her hair, I could be inventive and creative. So I was so attracted to her. Not physically, of course, but I was attracted to her personality, the way she was.
I want to talk to you about Mick Ronson, because early in your story, you're kind of running parallel. You're not intersecting so much yet before you become Mrs. Rono, right? Before you guys become a couple and all.
We were friends throughout that whole Ziggy period. He was a guitar player and I was a hairdresser costume mistress.
At what point did it get heated up? I don't want to be too graphic. But when did you two become more than that?
After Ziggy was finished, we all went on holiday to this villa in Rome, gorgeous place, and I was invited. And it was there that Mick and I first kind of looked at each other in a different way. And that was the beginning of our relationship. And after that, I mean, I couldn't believe my luck. Can you imagine it? I always thought he was the most gorgeous looking man. I mean, anyone that knows what he looks like will know that. And when you saw him on stage, what a performer. Oh my goodness, okay. What a performer he was. He was incredible.
I just listened to some of his performances with Dylan on the Hard Rain's Gonna Fall on that tour, and what he did for Dylan's music in that period. Unbelievable.
Unbelievable what he did for Dylan's music. I mean, I think even Bob Dylan was surprised, to be honest with you. I don't think Bob knew that Mick could play like that or do things like that. He didn't really like Bob Dylan. He used to play Bob Dylan's song like Yogi Bear.
I remember hearing Ziggy Stardust as a young kid, 10, 12 years old is about the time I got exposed to it. Late 70s. Yeah, it was late 70s, 78, I think was about the first time. And I have always been a big fan of Mick since then. His guitar sound, just smashed me right in the feels. And he had this special way that he played with feel that was very unique. He pulled you in with his sound, and he pulled me in as a kid and hooked me.
You know, no one played like me. No one played like that. And that, with that, that's without even appreciating his other talents, his string writing ability, the piano playing on Perfect Day on the Lou Reed album. Sublime. I mean, just a wonderful all-around musician.
You get reminded when you're doing a podcast like this about all the things, not just the ones that matter most to you or that you remember the best. And it's pretty impressive, the list of things that he was part of. And the reason is his tone was, like you said, so unique. And in that time period, as somebody who was right in the pocket for Ziggy and everything that was happening around there, we were zeroed in on that blonde guy on stage. You know what I'm saying? And oh, speaking of which, how much fun did you have when you did, I read the part of the book where you overdid a little and you did the rainbow colors in his hair, a little dye job.
Oh, isn't that funny?
Was he shitting himself when he looked in the mirror? Like,
as Woody said, God! When he woke up, he looked at himself and went, oh my God. And he called me right away and said, can you come down and take this out? And I was a bit hurt at the time. It wasn't until I saw him that I realized this was way too much. I had to do something.
And it seemed like Woody was more likely to be into the kind of work you might do with colors and hair because of his approach to hair in general. And, but boy, I just wish there were pictures of that we could all share, because you painted the picture so vividly in the book.
I didn't take a photograph. He was terrified that it wouldn't come out. But I did get it out for him.
One of the many things that are fun about this book, the stories, I can't even begin to quantify them. All kind of stories from different parts of what's going on in this time period for you and for Mick. And all weave through it is Bowie stuff. And your telling of Tony DeFreeze's part in everything is very good. I love it. I just love hearing.
Oh, I'm so glad. I'm so glad that you like it. Thank you.
Well, you're telling the story that we've heard from different angles, from a completely different point of view. And that's one of the reasons why any Bowie fan should be reading this book when it hits the stands. I'm not kidding around.
Oh, thank you very much. I mean, I knew I had a different story to tell. I knew I had something different here.
Why did you pick the specific timeline you chose, ending it where you did and starting it where you did, instead of going back a little further and maybe going on a little further?
Well, I thought it was the most exciting place to start, frankly. If going before that would have been another lengthy story, because, and I might do it again for a second book, you never know. But I've been to Italy, I had tried out lots of different things, which really I didn't think was that interesting. The most interesting thing that ever happened to me was meeting David Bowie. So I jumped in there, apart from the Beatles, which is where it very first starts. The end part, I had a baby. We went back to America. We moved to Woodstock and lived in the country. There wasn't that much going on at that point. You know, music changed. Music changed. It was the new romantics. And I just thought it was a good place to stop. I don't know why I did. I just kind of thought that was a good place to stop.
You had some interesting interactions with photography legend Mick Rock, who's a pretty cool dude in his day.
Oh, my darling Mick Rock. Oh, I miss him so much. I miss him so much. He died on my birthday. I'll never forgive him. 2 years ago, 3 years, my, you know, time goes by so quickly. But Mick used to come, you know, he lives in Staten Island, so he'd pop by and see me, you know, every 2 or 3 weeks. He'd come in, have a cup of ginger lemon tea and a little vegetarian snack. And we'd hang out. He was wonderful. One of my very best friends, yes.
Did you speak with Trevor or Woody in the later years? Had you spoken with them in the 90s and 2000s?
Woody. Woody, I do. I still speak to Woody here and there. He wrote a book too. I read his book. I thought his book was really interesting because he's the only member of the band left standing apart from Mike Garson. But Mike Garson wasn't one of the spiders. You know, he was never a spider. He was always a piano player. And he went to work on with Damien. He's also written a book. Mike is a fantastic keyboard player. Oh, my God. And what he brought to David's music. My husband was like, yes, yes. Because before, Mick would run from piano to guitar to fill in the different parts.
Right.
Once we got Mike, he didn't have to do that. And it was a nice change for him, I think.
And he's enjoyed a nice run in the role that he established in that post-Spiders band with David.
He has. And I think he still does it to this day. But he's such a fabulous keyboard player. I mean, I think Woody has been asked to go play with Mike, maybe in Vegas or something, which I think would be fantastic.
Could you tell us a little bit about your Philadelphia experiences? We're based in Philadelphia.
Oh, wow. The Tower Theater. What a venue. That's a rock and roll stronghold down there. I mean, the last time we were there, we were all so exhausted, it was kind of towards the end of the tour. And we used to play, we were there for a week, playing two shows a day. They loved Bowie in Philadelphia. I mean, I'd like to say that I went out and looked around, but I didn't. I was really busy. When you do a double show, you know, they do the show, they come off, the costumes are dripping, they're just very wet. And you have to hang them and press them. And the costumes at that point were so full of sweat, they almost stood up by themselves. You know, and also they were disintegrating. The fabric was like slowly falling apart. You know, they've been playing them. We've done two shows with that, two tours with those costumes. They were
right. Like, is that where the holy material look started to take, you know, Bowie setting a new trend? Again.
Yeah, I would back it up with fabric. I'd have to go find fabric and back it up with it whenever I could. Yeah.
I like that Lou Reed is part of your book. Him a couple times. He's one of my favorite humans ever. And your story about him, you describe him so well.
Well, he was an extraordinary person. Again, I was so suburban. To meet someone like Lou, it was a little scary. Sometimes meeting these people was a little scary. But
it was for me, too. It was when I met him, too. I was like,
yeah, but he's so nice. And I did his hair. But when I first met him, David was playing the Royal Albert Hall. The Festival Hall, the London Festival Hall. He was playing for Save the Whale. And Lou was guesting. Lou had flown to London along with Iggy. It was the week that was. I would say this was the week that was. Because David had done Top of the Pops, Starman. He had then played Aylesbury, which was our stronghold. And then he played, a few days after Top of the Pops, he was invited to play at the Royal Festival Hall for Save the Whale. And I went along because I was, you know, doing my thing. And Lou was there. Now, I thought Lou was a huge star in the States. The way that David and Angie used to talk about him, I thought he was a huge star in the States. But he's trembling backstage, you know. I mean, he looks great. Angie had bought him this black velvet suit with a little bolero top, and there were sparkles on the collars and cuffs. He looked amazing. His hair was like dark curls. I did some panda eyes on him, and he looked amazing. But I said to him, I said, are you nervous? And he just looked at me. He didn't say anything. And he said, how many people out there? I said, it's 2,000. You know, we've sold out. When I would say we'd sold out to David and the Spiders, they were in raptures. But this guy looked even more nervous, you know? So I took him to the side of the stage with my flashlight. Mick starts playing that throbbing riff, I'm Waiting for the Man. And Lou went on stage and the crowd went ballistic. They really did. It was a fabulous gig. They played so gorgeously. Lou all rock and roll darkness and the band all glam and glitter. It was a wonderful show.
Those kinds of moments are special in rock and roll history. And hearing about it as you got to experience makes it really kind of gives us goosebumps. At least I'm getting goosebumps hearing about it because I love hearing these stories. I love history, and I love the fact that this time period that we're talking about had such a huge impact on music, on society in general at that time, style, fashion. I mean, drug culture was impacted by David Bowie. It all was impacted by David Bowie.
But, you know, when you're living it, you don't realize. If anyone had been telling me I've been talking about this damn fool haircut some 50-something years later, I'd be like, really? I couldn't have imagined it. But you live for the moment, don't you?
As we live in this glam moment with Susie Ronson talking about Me and Mr. Jones, My Life with David Bowie and the Spiders from Mars, let's take a quick break and grab a pint from Crooked Eye.
Well, Marcus, the seasons are changing and the board is changing at Crooked Eye because you know what happens. You always have your standards there on the left side. If you look at it on social media, you know exactly what I'm talking about, right?
Yeah, their pictures lay it out very clearly for you what they've got. So
keep your eye on that, sure. But on the right side of the board, That's where the spring ales and the new stuff that Jeff's been working on starts coming out and making its way into your glass right there at the bar at Crooked Eye Brewery in the heart of Hapro, pouring the cure for over 10 years now, just celebrating their 10th anniversary. The party's still going on over there. You know that, man, right?
The party never stops at Crooked Eye with live music, great entertainment, with just things happening at Crooked Eye, the great beers, the great drinks. It never stops.
And get that Salty Vets barbecue on select nights. You can find out about everything going on at Crooked Eye Brewery on their Facebook and other social media accounts. And thanks to them always for sponsoring us here on the podcast. Always a friend to be made. When you make a Crooked Eye.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
We are back and ready for more about the glam period around Ziggy Stardust and the Spiders from Mars with Susie Ronson on the imbalanced history of rock and roll.
This is something I've been wanting to ask you. As someone who was there at the end of the Spiders, when everybody found out that night and then the days leading up to that and afterwards, what was that like to be an insider?
Well, for me, I found out in Japan. I was privy to the conversation in Japan between Tony DeFreeze, Mick Ronson, and David Bowie. So Mick and I knew, but we were sworn to secrecy. You know, Tony had said to Mick, you're the next star. You're going to be the next one making your solo record. I was told that if I didn't keep my mouth shut, I'd lose my job. Well, that was enough to terrify me. I didn't want to go back to Beckenham. But it was a weight that I carried with me through that last English tour. I was hoping that he might change his mind. I mean, why break up something that was going so well? I was really hoping he might change up his mind. But that last night, seeing him on, pressing the costume, thinking, is this the last time I'm going to be pressing this costume? And then standing him on stage, he didn't say much to me. He was quite cold. I don't think he was sure of what he was doing, but he wanted to do it. I think he was exhausted. I think being Ziggy was like exhausting for him. I mean, I think he'd done it and done it. All those shows, there were so many shows back to back. And then, you know, when you're not doing a show, please do this interview. Let's do this. Let's do that. Let's do the other thing. Well, it's a lot. And then come up with another record. I mean, being famous, getting there is one thing. Staying there is quite another. So I think he was ready.
Everyone in rock and roll will tell you that's the thing. Getting there may be hard enough.
That's the thing. It's a keeping it up is the hard part. So then he actually said it. And there was a big party at the Cafe Royal afterwards. I didn't go because he hadn't told Woody and Trevor. And I felt really badly about that. I felt horrible about that.
It had to be hard.
Well, I mean, how much they have felt? Humiliated, shaken to their core. And I didn't want to be questioned by them. I didn't go. I just got drunk with the roadies instead. I didn't go to that last party. And then I saw him, I don't know how long, a few weeks later, I guess, we were going to France to do pinups. And I went over there to, you know, I just looked after them, whatever. And then I looked at him there and he just, I mean, I was very cross with him that he was so bad not to have told the band. But then I looked at him and it was like a huge weight had been lifted off his shoulders. He just looked younger and more relaxed. But then when we went to Italy right after that, I could see he was thinking, what the fuck have I done? Sorry, what have I done? You know, I've broken up my band. What am I going to do now? And I think he was starting to panic a little bit.
What if he had reversed stream and gone back the other way? Too late?
He couldn't have done that. I mean, he could have before he said it. He could not have said anything and done it a different way, but he wanted that big, flamboyant, we're never going to tour again moment. And of course, you know, it made all the press and blah, blah, blah.
I guess when you think about it, in order for Bowie to continue to develop musically, which was important to all of us as much as music was more important to us as teenagers and young adults back then. Otherwise, he doesn't progress, and maybe he loses interest along the way.
That, when we talked about it, he'd be stuck in the same old thing. He'd be stuck being Ziggy forever. And I think that terrified him. He didn't want to remain Ziggy forever. He wanted to do other things, play with other people. I always like to think if Mick had lived, I mean, I think he spoke to David over the years, but I think if Mick had lived, there would have been another Mick Ronson, David Bowie album. I'm sure of it. It just hadn't got to that point yet. Mick was only 46 when he died. He wasn't old. So I think there would have been other chances to play with David. You know, music's funny. It goes up and down. And Mick's time is coming round again. You know, he'd just done the Morrissey album, one of the best albums Morrissey's ever done. And I think there was a chance. He was starting to get a lot more calls. He'd played with The Who. You know, there was a few things he'd done that if he hadn't been ill, I think Mick would have rebounded and done very well.
After the timeline in the book, did you ever work with David Bowie again doing any costume work?
I did not. David's like that. Once you're gone, man. You are gone. When Mick was doing his solo album, I naively thought that David would be around, you know, to give him a hand or do this and that. But we never heard him. And I think that was the time when he started doing a lot of cocaine. And you know, when you do cocaine, you don't think of much anything else. You just think about that. When you're doing that, that is your main focus. So I think he was doing a lot of that, because, you know, when most people fool around with that thing, you can all get your little half a gram and, oh, it might last you a day. And, oh, and then that's it, because you can't afford to do it anymore.
Yeah, no
but when
kidding.
You're someone like David, it's just lined up for you, isn't it, really?
That's the way it was, yeah.
Yeah. So that might have had something to do with it.
Straying from the book a little bit, you mentioned the Morrissey album that you did. Did Rono ever play with Johnny Marr or have a professional relationship with him? Because I think those two both play really well in a feel style. And while they're totally different guitar players, there are similarities in their energy.
I think he met him and he might have played with him, but I never saw it. I wasn't around. Remember, I lived in Woodstock, New York when I had a child. Mick was in the city a lot and he didn't always report everything that he did. So he might have. I don't really know. I think he probably spoke to David more than I knew as well, because I was cross with David. I thought he was going to help Mick and he didn't. So I think he might have spoken to David more than I knew. I mean, we did see David when he did Black Tie, White Noise. Mick did a track on that. But otherwise, you know, David was very concerned with being David. You know, very concerned with being David. And it took a lot of time and attention. Look at Diamond Dogs. I mean, look at the things he did.
Well, he had to reinvent himself every 6 to 9 months. Yeah.
Not bloody easy.
No.
Not easy.
Well, you know, a lot of artists go through a reinvention or a repositioning of their career. Maybe once they pivot, right? Or twice.
Oh, they take a couple of years to do it. David could kind of spin on a dime, you know. He was so clever at that. I know Mick and I struggled with that. And this one I was saying in the book as well. I met Glenn Matlock and we went to the punk clubs. And I'm standing there in my glitter and my high heels. You know, Mick's got his little bit of mascara on, his blonde hair. And we're surrounded by these punks. And I felt like my time had come and gone. And I hadn't even seen it pass me by. Mm. Things change very quickly.
There's some people who are bigger than big.
Yes. Well, the difference between good and great is huge.
Well,
there's a lot of very good people out there. There's very few great people.
The story about Placido Domingo. So amazing. Talk about great. If I'm David David Bowie, right? At that point, if I'm David Bowie and they're talking about Placido, I'm looking at and going, okay, I'm willing to look up to him, because even though I'm at the top of my game, he was on a whole different level.
Oh, a whole different level, but I didn't even know Placido Domingo was. I was a 22-year-old from Beckenham, and he thought I was really attractive. He wanted to ask me, and I'm like, oh, no thanks. It's so crazy. I know. Believe you me, I kicked myself. God knows where my life might have been if I had decided. But I think he was married at that time, so I'd have just been one of those girls, you know.
You have the distinction of being one of the few people I've ever talked to who stayed at the infamous Edgewater Inn. That must have been
My God, yes. And the poor bloody sharks.
Yes.
I felt so sorry for them. I mean, sharks have to move to live.
Right. People forget that.
Yeah. And they just stuck it in a bathtub, poor bloody thing. I felt very sorry for that shark. I'm a big animal lover, so I felt horrible about that. I remember, I think we'd smoked a little pot, and I went downstairs in the room where you have drinks, and there's huge windows, and the shark was swimming up the window. I'm thinking, damn, that pot shark, that pot strong. But it wasn't. Someone had caught a shark and they were pulling it up past the windows. Horrible.
Ugh. Let's bounce back to the Tower Theater for a happier subject, because that's where you guys met Mott the Hoople, right?
Not at that time. David had given Mott the Hoople all the Young Dudes. It had been a success. Mott didn't break up. They went on tour in America. We, at some point, our tours kind of were close to each other. David, I think, was coming in after Mott by about a week or something to the Tower. So we went, David, I went to do his hair. David was going to introduce them. And he did. He introduced them. The crowd went wild, which was so good. And then afterwards, he did the encore number with. He sang all the Young Dudes with them. And it was a fabulous night. I mean, they're a very different bunch, Mott. I mean, Ian and Trudy are still friends of mine to this day. But Ian kind of scared me a bit too, because he never took his glasses off. He'd look to this guy a bit like you know, no one had the glasses off. Well, back then, that kind of made me nervous, you know, when he wouldn't take his glasses off. But he always said he had eyes like two piss holes in a snowbank. And it was true. He had very small kind of blue eyes, and he didn't want people to see him. So he was like that. But they were very different, the back to David and the Spiders. Very different band.
You've known so many people through, you know, musical associations and stuff. It's just fascinating to talk to you about all this.
The story of Jack and Diane is, I love that story and how it was in the scrap pile and Rano looked at it and was like, oh, wait a minute. And there it is.
He put some baby rattles on it. And John said, what baby rattles? And it was, Mick added some little touches to it and made it, you know, the hit it became. Yeah.
That says a lot about his feel and his ear as not only a musician, but a producer, and just how talented Rana was and how essential he and the other guys were to David Bowie during that time period.
The first string arrangement Mick ever wrote was Life on Mars.
One of my faves.
I mean, gorgeous. And when you look at the work, he did a lot of the production on Lou Reed's album, Transformer. A lot of that production work was Mick. All the strings, all the piano. As I say, Perfect Day. What a track. And that was Mick Ronson.
When you guys would hang out together and listen to music, what music did you listen to together?
He liked Little Feet. It depends what time you're talking about, of course. He liked Little Feet. He liked Steely Dan. He liked a lot of different stuff. He liked some Spanish music. He liked Italian music. He loved Pure Prairie League. And after, of course, we hang out with Bob Dylan, we listened to a lot of country stuff because we had not really been exposed that much to country music before. So Ramblin' Jack Elliott, Diamonds and Rust, Joan Baez, Joni Mitchell, Kinky Friedman, that crazy fool.
It sounds like me and Rano and you would have been a perfect hangout and smoke a couple joints partners back in the day, because, I mean, Steely Dan and Little Feet are two of my favorites from those days.
He loved that band. I listened to Robert Palmer, who, ironically, he was in a very similar time period to Mick.
You know, I hate it when people say it, but maybe it was true. The music was better then. Maybe it was.
Well, I think it's because of our age. I mean, I do, because every kid has got its own generation of music. I mean, you hear the rap, but I mean, Biggie Smalls was no slouch. Great lyricist, Biggie Smalls. And I'm not a big rap fan, but the rap of back then, Biggie Smalls, Tupac, that was some pretty serious bloody rap.
Oh, yeah.
But I think it's just about age. Everybody has their own time with their music and what reminds them of certain times of their lives. People would argue with you that Elvis Presley and Frank Sinatra had us beaten into a corner, but they didn't, did they? Everyone's got their time, I think.
Well, the thing is, Marcus and I are musical adventurers. We keep absorbing new music as we go through life. A lot of people find their zone and kind of stop. But I found that I listen to a lot of the music that I've acquired over the last 20 years in my head, right? But I also enjoy more now going back to those 70s records that I have on CD. And it reminds me of a different time in the music business. And maybe
world.
But in our business that we all chose to be in and around. And it was so different and wonderful. And it's really great to get you on the podcast to give us a snapshot, a picture, a point of view about these events that you witnessed and were part of.
It wasn't until I read a couple of biographies about was one record executive that wrote about his time, that I realized that we were all just playing the game. We were all starting out doing this. I mean, RCA sold washing machines. You know, it was like they'd only started to create. They did. They were a household items company before they got into music. And they were kind of, they got Elvis and they were right on the cusp. But a lot of people, we were all cutting our teeth, I think, at that point.
Yeah, it's really fascinating because now the music industry is completely different. And to go see a band at a small venue, you got to drop $100 a ticket now.
100?
For small venues. I'm not talking like the Pearl Jam shows that are $300 to $400 to $800 a ticket, or Fleetwood Mac that's $600, $700, $800 a ticket, or Taylor Swift. It doesn't matter. Those big arena shows are expensive as well.
Very expensive.
It's a whole different animal.
I don't know what you see. I've always liked smaller venues better. I mean, I'd love to see Taylor Swift just because she's such a phenomenon. But it's all polished, isn't it? You don't think anything's going to go wrong, do you? Sometimes at our show, things would go wrong and it made it all the more hilarious and real.
Mm-hmm.
And that doesn't happen much these days, I don't think. I mean, the equipment alone. We had dried ice. Wow. All those companies, obviously, lighting company, were in their infancy.
Yeah. Back then, anything that moved had to have human hands on it. You know, now it's all computer-driven and stuff. It's neat for the artist to design.
The desks must have had computers, but the dried ice was kind of buckets you tipped over at the back of the stage. And it wasn't, you know, the lights are follow spots, people on follow spots. And if you got to change a bulb, you burnt your fingers. I mean, all that kind of a thing is long gone.
You know, in the book, you tell a lot of stories. You paint pictures. But there's one story from Japan where you're all sitting down to dinner and this fish, you call it, say it's beautiful, head and tail still on, scored into thin pieces, ready to be picked up and eaten raw, I guess, with chopsticks and all the stuff you need, the carrots, the, you know, the wasabi and the bowls of soy sauce. How weird was that for you? Because you think you see the fish wiggle and you're thinking it might still be kind of alive, that fresh. Got a weird yeah.
I never knew what sushi was. There was no sushi. We never had any sushi anywhere. Not even in California, there was no sushi. And I looked at it. First of all, it was raw. That was raw. And then it wasn't wiggling, but there was a shiver in. And I'm like, that thing's still alive. That is still alive. And I looked at Trevor. I said, I think I just saw that shiver. Oh, I couldn't eat it. And I never thought I'd ever eat sushi, ever.
Well, also in that time frame at that show, David faces off with the stoic reaction of the Japanese fans. I guess it's the way that they were taught to react. Until he comes out for his encore and his jockstrap, what was the reaction like? And how crazy was that for you as somebody who's in the entourage to see something like that happen just to get a rise out of the crowd?
He said to me, I think I'm going back on a jockstrap. And I looked, that's when I on there. I said, let this on there, make it look a bit more like it's something, you know? Well, the crowd went crazy. They just went like, bah! You know, it was crazy because, I mean, David was perfect person to wear something like that. You couldn't put many blokes in a jock strap like that and have it look as good as he. He was hairless, no hair, no body hair, white. Dancer's legs. David had very strong legs because he was a dancer. So he was a perfect person to wear that. And he could move. He could really move well. That shook everybody, including the band, probably.
I can see Trevor being like, what just happened?
Whatever David did, they were right there behind him. They were a fabulous band.
Oh, they were an amazing band. And one of the bands that had a huge impact on my life. What did you learn about yourself writing this book? What new things did you learn about yourself putting this book together?
First of all, I could write a book. I never thought I actually could do that. I'm not a well-educated person. I left school when I was 15. So to actually be able to do it, and I thought I was quite pleased with the way that I wrote it, the present tense, walking you through a story. It was something different. It was something I'd thought about doing for a long time, but I really hadn't got the courage. It wasn't until I met Meg Bowles from The Moth, who encouraged me to write that little 10-minute story, which I tell to this day on stage, then I realized that I might be able to do it. And then I did it. I was going to use a co-writer, but they didn't really seemed to understand what I was trying to do. Because they, oh, what date was that? I said, it's not, it doesn't matter what date it is. The dates are not, the years obviously are, and I wanted to get it in some kind of chronological order, but every day, no, it's not what I'm doing. So I just thought I'll give it a go by myself, and I did. I was lucky enough to meet a man, Tom Wilcox, my manager, who knew Hanif Qureshi, who wrote the, what's it called, The Buddha from Suburbia, and My Beautiful Laundromat. And he saw it and he loved it and took it to favor for me. So I was very fortunate to know a couple of people that had an interest. Yes, I was.
Well, I'm just happy to have the time with you after a time zone faux pas and a couple of false starts to finally get together with you to talk about all these wonderful stories. And me and Mr. Jones is just the kernel of the book. There's so much great rock history in there. You're telling of Mick's path to a certain point in his role in Dylan's Rolling Thunder review, which, by the way, I can't say enough good things about his performance there.
Fabulous, wasn't he?
Yes.
Oh, my God, he transformed it.
He did a great job there. He really did.
But thank you for coming on. So if you're wondering and you're a fan of music in general, and Bowie specifically, just go get the book when it's out, Me and Mr. Jones. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Thank you very much for this time.
What an incredible conversation. I'm probably repeating myself, but she told us both here on the podcast and in her book about so many things that we never knew. And you and I are both students of the whole Ziggy game on both sides of Bowie's career and all the things around it.
Yeah, the whole story of David Bowie and his career and the changing of characters or personas is brilliant and fun and fascinating and wild and insane. And to hear the beginnings of David Bowie and the Spiders from Mars, or Ziggy Stardust and the Spiders from Mars, from the perspective of fashion, hair, design, and how things went behind the scenes is fascinating. And yes, Ms. Susie told a wonderful story and just really made you feel like you were living in the moment.
From the inside, which is different than all the other books that have been written about that era.
Yes, and again, thank you again to the Pantheon Podcast Network for hosting us, and big thanks to Megan from Pegasus Books for getting us a copy of this book to read before it was released, because I highly recommend this book for music lovers. I know Ray does as well. And another cool aspect of it is not only do you get to hear the story of the Spiders from Mars, but one of the many peripheral stories is the love story of Mick and Susie Ronson. And it's really cool how all of that worked out in this little time period. One of the many eras of David Bowie.
I'll just say this as we wrap things up. I think we're going to look back on this episode in a while and go, man, that was one of our good ones. And it's always a good one on the bar when you go in to see our sponsors at Crooked Eye Brewery in the heart of Hapro, pouring the cure since 2014, over 10 years now, pal. Signing off from the Dark Duck Media Studios for this episode, all about me and Mr. Jones and Susie Ronson. I'm Ray Coop.
I'm Marcus Goldman.
As always, we are the imbalanced history
of rock and roll.